All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a packed show. It's going to be one of my favorite shows, I know. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an excerpt from the film B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live. And this excerpt is called, How Long Must This Nightmare of Oppression and Brutality Go On? Very fitting for these times, I'll say that. But before that, we have the writer and director and two of the actors, the two actors in a play called Dreamscape, which I have to tell you folks, you've got to pay attention on this one. It is one of the heaviest and one of the most profound plays I've seen in a very long time. So definitely, if you got to get a drink of water, you got to go to the bathroom, do it before you hear this interview, because this is going to have you riveted, all right? It should have you riveted. Opening the show up, I'm pleased in some ways, very pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix, but also in other ways, just very angry that we do this, it seems, week after week after week. Carl Dix is from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he's going to be here talking with us today about the killing of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Let's just jump right into this. You wrote a statement about Freddie Gray's murder, and in it you basically pose why. You know, and I want to jump into that because it's the thing that keeps pounding at you, you know? Why so many people did?
Yeah, well, what it comes down to is so many people are dead at the hands of the police because this is the concentration of a slow genocide targeting Black and Latino people. I mean, you have a system that has ripped the legitimate ways to survive and raise families out of the inner cities, and their program for dealing with the people who are left with little or nothing to survive is cops, courts, and laws targeting people and criminalizing people. And that all is at issue in Freddie's murder, because here you have a young Black man, 8:40 in the morning, walking the streets. Police roll in, and Freddie decides to leave. And then the police take that as that's criminal behavior, and they chase him, they tackle him, and they arrest him for nothing more than he ran when they came. They arrested him, and in arresting him may have injured him severely because he's screaming like he's in excruciating pain as they drag him to the van, put him in the police van, handcuffed. And then they drive around the city. He's already asked for medical attention. In addition to screaming around pain, he suffered from asthma. He's asking for medical attention. They drive him around the city for 20, 25 minutes. And the distance from where they picked him up to the police station is like 5 or 6 city blocks. They could have driven it in a couple of minutes, but they drove him around. And he's in the back of the car handcuffed, with no seat belts, being bounced around, and something that the police in Baltimore call giving you the rough ride. Freddie, when they finally get him to the station, he is unconscious. They finally call an ambulance. They get him to the hospital and find out that his spine has been severed. And they operate on him, put him in a medically induced coma, but he dies a week later. So this is what happened, and then we get a cast of characters coming out and telling people, be calm, don't assume that the police did anything wrong, let our investigations play out. And then at the same time, we have apologists from the police saying, Freddie did this to himself in the back of the van. This is what people get told, but the good thing that happened here is that people weren't having it this time.
Well, let me interrupt for a minute here because I want to pursue a couple of other things here, because some of the things,
okay.
I mean, I'm listening to what you're saying, and it's so enraging. You know, and I keep thinking about this, that even the explanations that they sort of put out there, which is, and it's terrible to even call them explanations, but the idea that, one, they don't feel they compelled at all to explain the gap in terms of what happened in the van, you know, and how did he actually have his mind severed. They also, and this is something that's very heavy when you think about what you've been talking about and emphasizing for a number of years now, this point about the genocidal assault against Black and brown people. The cops first said, well, he had a knife. Of course, there was no way for them to know he had a knife. And then they also said, a city official said, well, it's not necessarily illegal that he had the knife, but the cops say he had a knife. And then they say, well, we can stop him because he was in a high crime area. Think of what that means. We can stop him because he was in a high crime area. What is that saying about the value of black lives?
Yeah, what it says is that black people in this society go through their life with a target on their back. And just for being black, and it was nothing else, just for being black and being in that area, the police feel they have the authority to harass you, abuse you, brutalize you, and arrest you, and if necessary, kill you. And all of that flows from just being black and in that area. I call it being treated like permanent suspects, guilty until proven innocent, if you can survive to prove your innocence. And Freddie Gray was not able to survive, just as a wave of people, an intensifying wave of people, have not been able to survive those encounters. And look, it's got to stop, and it's up to us to make it stop, because the authorities ain't going to do nothing about it. There are investigations, and they've already got 3 investigations going into this case, but they've investigated cases before, all the way up to the Justice Department, and the killer cops continue to walk free. So even getting an investigation doesn't mean anything. Don't tell us that you're going to look into policies. Killer cops need to be indicted, convicted, and put in jail. And people have to stand up and demand that and say that this must stop, which is the spirit and the mood of a lot of people in Baltimore. I mean, 2,000 people were out Tuesday night. Every night since, there's been hundreds of people, multiple demonstrations happening, moving all throughout the city, blocking traffic all over the place. And that and much more is needed. And the other thing is, people need to get organized. They need to get organized to carry this fight for justice forward. They need to connect with the nationwide movement. And they need to get with the movement for revolution, because this wanton murder by police that is backed up by the whole system is built into the fabric and framework of this system. It's the continuation of the patrols that went around the plantations to make sure the slaves didn't escape. It's a continuation of the Ku Klux Klan and lynch mob terror of the post-Civil War period, and now it's the police doing it. It's got to stop, and ultimately it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to stop it. And that's a message that we've been taking out, because a group of people from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the New York City Revolution Club have been down here for the past few days, and we're going to be joined by more people on this Saturday, because I've issued a call for people to act in solidarity with the people of Baltimore on this Saturday. You can't get to Baltimore, do something where you are. You can get to Baltimore, join us in the streets. There's going to be a Stop Mass Incarceration Network contingent raising the demand of justice for Freddie Gray and an end to police getting away with murder.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the just brutal, horrible murder of Freddie Gray by the Baltimore police. Now, Carl, we have about 5 more minutes left, and I wanted to actually approach this thing, too, because, you know, one of the things that I was saying, I think everything that you're saying is extremely important, including what the actual solution to this is. And at the same time, just to emphasize that, because there is a point about what do you do in the face of a genocide. And if anybody had any doubt about this, if anybody had the slightest doubt, I mean, you can think about the kinds of things that are going on. When you see that picture of Freddie Gray hogtied, basically backwards, as somebody said, bent like an origami. It's like you see that and you expect all you need is a pole shoved between his ankles and his arms, and they could be carrying him off, like repeated thousands of images of captured slaves. You know, you think about that. You think about the fact that when the people do go out in the street, these bastards call them lynch mobs. Imagine that. They're calling the people lynch mobs.
Yeah, that was one of the police apologists saying that the protesters were lynch mobs. And look, he's calling the people who are protesting the murder of a young black man by a squad of Baltimore City cops, an act that is repeated dozens of times each and every month by police all across the city. And he's calling people protesting that lynch mobs. He's trying to turn up into down and right into wrong. And we ain't having it. But it is like, this is an extremely widespread problem. And when you see that, and see that this is just the concentration of an overall program of suppression, mass incarceration, courts, and laws set up to target Black and Latino people especially. That's what we're dealing with. And if you're going to confine yourself to the channels the system has out there for you, you have already lost, because the whole system is backing up this slow genocide and escalating its pace. And you got to say, we have to take on the system that's responsible for this and end its criminal rule, because that's what it comes down to, a criminal system unleashing its enforcers to carry out crimes against the people. And that's why I say it's going to take revolution, nothing less. And we are building a movement for revolution. We've got the leadership for it in Bob Avakian, a man who's dedicated decades of his life to addressing everything that stands between humanity and its ultimate emancipation. We've got a strategic approach for getting from where we are now to the point where revolution could be possible. We call that fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. And look, if people hate this horror and all the other horrors that this system brings down, from the attack on women, trying to strip them of the right to abortion, the drone missile strikes, the devastation of the environment, they need to get with this movement for revolution. And the way to do that, go to the website revcom.us. You'll see all kinds of stuff up there that you need to know. You need to get introduced to this revolution and get with it. People also need to go to the website stopmassincarceration.net and get involved in this movement to stop the slow genocide that's coming down on people.
All right, Carl, we're going to wrap this up. Let's just stay in touch, man, because this is obviously and clearly a developing scene. And I keep thinking, too, in the wake of April 14th, the day of Shut It Down, Stop Police Murder of Black and Brown People, you think about this. This is not to be tolerated anymore. And in a way, what came onto the scene in April 14th has a lot to do with what needs to happen these days.
Definitely.
All right, Carl. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about the brutal police murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore and the response of the people out in the streets standing up and saying, we demand justice. We demand that the cops be indicted and convicted. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the writer, director, and cast of the play Dreamscape. You do not want to miss this segment. All right, welcome back. That was Jasiri X with Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder. It's a statement. People just need to think about that and then decide what you're going to do about it, all right? They don't let them get away with murder. Way too many times that has to be talked about, way too many times, and it needs to be talked about every time it happens, because we cannot allow this to go unanswered, and we cannot continue to live in a society that treats a whole section of people as if they're nothing but work animals. And even now, it's like they have no use. They have no use for Black and brown people. They have no use for Black people in this society. So what are they doing? Terrorizing, genocide. And I went to see a play, and it was one of the most powerful plays I've seen in my entire life. And I've seen a lot of plays, I'll tell you. You know, it was incredible. And the play is called Dreamscape. And joining us to talk about this today is the director, Kirby Hines. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having us.
Okay. And Rachel Walker. She plays the lead character in the play, although it's a little difficult to describe as lead, but it is the center of the play, the heart of the play. And John, you're going to have to help me with this. It's John Foss?
Yes.
John Foss Merchant?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Who is the most incredible beatbox, just incredible. I mean, he creates the entire soundscape. And listen, folks, with his mouth, okay? That's it. And it was like, it was just crazy. So let's jump into this, because like I said, the play really just, and I, you know, the night I was there, I don't think there was a dry eye in the house.
Yes, yes.
You know, people were sobbing. you know, and there's sobbing and then there's an anger and there's a search for an understanding. And I wanted to ask you, let's talk about the genesis, the origins of the play, because this wasn't like something that was easy for you to do.
Yes. No, this this play was one of those plays that I was reluctant to write. I knew about the incident. The play is based on the shooting of Tyesha Miller, a young woman, back in 1998 in Riverside, California. And I knew about the incident when it happened, and I was reluctant to write this play. As a playwright, we're often looking for things that move us and that want us to tell those stories. I knew about the incident, and I didn't want to tell this story because I didn't like the place that it put me in when I thought about it. Also, I didn't think I had the ability to write it, but also, I didn't want to feel like I was capitalizing on something so tragic. So it took me until 2005 to write Dreamscape. And when I sat down to write it, I wanted to make sure that it was a piece of theater that could be transcendent, something that could be about this specific incident, but that could also be about all these types of incidents and all these types of moments that occur within the African-American community specifically, but really within communities that are powerless, communities that are at someone else's, under someone else's control.
Well, let me ask you, before we get into that exactly, let me ask you this, because I read somewhere where you said that this play was born of necessity.
Yes.
You know, let's talk about that, because it's kind of heavy, because like you're saying, you see this, and look, I was living out here when Tyesha Miller got killed,
yeah.
You know, and how I remember how I felt, and I remember how angry I was, but my initial thing would have been, write something, damn it, say something, do something. But you step back a minute, because you know, and it was more, I think it was, it seems like to me, it was more than just sort of, well, would I be jumping on this and sort of, you know, jumping to do something that maybe shouldn't be done now or shouldn't be done at that moment. But you said it was actually, when you decided to do it, that it was actually, you had to do it because it was born of necessity.
Yes. Yes. There is, so as an artist, we talk about the fact that we what is inside of us is what comes out on a page or on a stage or however we express our artistry. For me, having a 22-year-old African-American son and watching him grow up, this was 2005, so he was, you know, much younger at that point, and looking at what kind of existence he would have if things continued the way they continued. And so as a father and as a man, it became necessary for me to do something. And people do things within the context of their existence, meaning I'm a playwright, I'm a director. So for me, the thing to do was to create something that could speak to how do we alter this? How do we change this? How do I leave the world a little better for him when I'm gone? And so that was the specific and the immediate part of the reason for creating this play. I was also in Cincinnati, Ohio from 1998 to 2000. And during that period, there were about 18 African-American men who were shot over a three-year period by authorities in a very small radius area around the University of Cincinnati. And so once again, this resonated with me as well as, you know, the presence of my son, as well as being aware of the Tyesha Miller case, as well as having lived in L.A. and you know, been around during the Rodney King uprising. And so all of these things came together and they forced me to write this play.
Mm-hmm. Although you also said, I'm not writing a bioplay. I'm not writing something that's just going to go out there and say, this is Tyesha Miller's
Absolutely.
Life.
You know, I took the liberty of using the incident as the point of departure for a play that explored the relationship between the African-American community and the police, the historic kind of tenuous relationship that has existed since emancipation, that has existed through Jim Crow, that has existed through the 60s, through the 70s. And so this play was intended to explore that relationship and not to talk about Tyesha Miller, who she was, what she might have grown up to be, what her existence was like on a daily basis. But with that said, the point was to write a play that explored the idea of answering the question, if I was a 19-year-old African-American woman being shot by the police in 1998, what thoughts might be going through my head? What might I think about when I'm shot in the arm or in the leg or in the head? And so using that as the impetus for the dialogue, for the narrative, for the stories, I coupled that with the police report, with the 911 call, with the coroner's report, and created a piece that is it's a hybrid of fact-based theater as well as more traditional playwriting with the elements or the aesthetics of hip-hop theater that drives the narrative.
And we're going to get into that in just a little bit.
Yes.
John. Rachel, let me ask you this, because one of the things, when I'm listening to Kirby and what he's saying, it's like it's very moving, but it's also there's also a question here of one of the things that he did, that he does, and he's kind of being very modest here, but, you know, when I think back on what happened to Taisha Miller, for so many of us that were angry about it, you know, to a large extent, not for the family and other people that knew her, but for so many of us, she was left as one-dimensional. And what Rick Kirby's done and what you do, and you too, John, what you bring to this, but when you as the actor in the play, you bring such an amazing all-sidedness. You fill Taisha Miller, you fill that character out, Maisha Mills, the character in the play, but you fill her out. And so what we see there is just such a flowering of life, and it makes the snuffing out of that so much more, you know, enraging. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, I wanted to bring the character to life. I wanted to do this play justice and to really allow the idea and the humanity of this character to come across, and the beauty of her and her confidence and everything she does, the way she moves. I just wanted to really put that out there and make it as poetic and beautiful as it was written.
You know, it's interesting because one of the person that I went to see the play with was saying, you know, that it was just sort of like, you know, you look at it and there was one scene in there where you're describing how all these colleges were looking at you and were offering you, you know, a possibility of going to college. But I forgot to turn in. But see, there's a beauty to that because there's so many kids that age, you know, and there's so many kids that, you know, particularly people who, you know, you can strive all you want, but sometimes you got to face the reality that this society is not, you could end up Freddie Gray with a severed spine, you know? And this is something really beautiful that you brought to that, because you brought the humanity out in the most beautiful way possible. Now, a lot of it had to do with the words, but you also instilled it. And quite frankly, your dance is incredible, okay?
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's talk about that a little, because the dance actually, you have this whole thing of sort of, there's so much that's sort of both concentrated in and explodes.
Yes.
At 12 times during the show, basically, or maybe more.
Yes. Well, we have an amazing choreographer. Her name is Carrie Michaels, and we work together. She choreographed the beginning dance, the end, and some in between we mostly work together on. Through the years, it has changed. It has built, because with John and I working together so closely, what it has become during when she's being shot in those particular spaces, what I do is I just think of, okay, so where the gunshot hit, what does it affect and how does it affect it? And with his voice and his amazing, powerful beats, I do my best to recreate that within the movement. And that's where it comes from for me.
How hard was it to go from bullet-riddled dead person to vivacious teenager?
Oh.
Constantly.
It is a challenge. It is a struggle. What has helped me through the years is meditation, being able to control my breath, being able to control a state of mind that I put myself in, and being able to be in that space when I need to be in that space.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today we're talking with the director and writer of the play Dreamscape, Rick Kirby Hines, and the actors Rachel Walker and John Foz Merchant. John, let's move over to you for a minute here.
Yes, sir.
Wow. I couldn't believe it. Folks, you have to understand, the set is two dining room chairs back to back, okay? And in the beginning, you see Rachel come out, but John's sitting there, and it's just, how the hell did you come up with the beats in that, the sound, the entire soundscape from you, including the fact that you play a number of different characters in the play?
Yes.
This is a hell of a job.
Thank you. I've been beatboxing, started when I was 6 years old, and in relation to the play, there were, when I initially got the script, there were certain samples that were written in by Rick Kirby, and the rest of it was, you know, scratches, samples in series of ones, twos, and basically Rick Kirby gave me the freedom to go out and explore different samples to incorporate, and what I did was I researched and came back with different songs and samples that would be related to the particular gunshot in particular to the character that Rachel was developing, to find out, you know, what might she have been listening to, or what was my favorite song during that time, to kind of make it even more real and to examine the language that hip hop presents to us, you know, and what that does to our culture and how it almost kind of takes us away from reality, but then also bring you back to that reality.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Do you guys have something prepared that people can hear?
All right. Yes.
Of course.
Why don't you set it up, tell people what it is, and then we'll go to it.
Okay, great. So what we are going to, this is the prologue. This is the very beginning of the play. And this is the Maisha character bringing us into her thoughts when she first hears the cops' sirens approaching the gas station where she was passed out in the car. So this is that scene.
Soon as I hear the cop sirens, the first thing to pop into my mind, man, I wish I was a white girl. Not white in the I got blue eyes and I can flip my hair kind of way, but in the officer, can you help me out kind of way. In the young lady, are you okay? You look distressed kind of way. In the are you okay? You look lost. You need a ride kind of way. But not today. Tonight, my name is Maisha, and I'm black. Might have had a little drink, those are just the facts. But even still with all that, I figure I should still be all right. I mean, if Tony couldn't hear me, I must be asleep, right? And if I'm sleeping, I'm dreaming, so it must be deep, right? And if I'm deep asleep, the police will just wake me up, right? Show some care, help me find a spare, even help jack me up, right? To protect and to serve, written in black and white, right?
I observed that the vehicle's occupant was in dire medical distress and in need of immediate medical assistance. I observed that the vehicle's occupant's mouth was slightly open, her eyes were closed, her breathing appeared shallow, her lips were quivering, her body was shaking, and there was a white substance that was accumulating around the sides of her mouth. Based on my prior experience with persons overdosing on drugs, I believe Mills was experiencing symptoms which were consistent with drug overdose. Believing that time was of the essence, I thought that we should use the quickest means available to remove the gun from her presence to make it safe for emergency personnel to render any aid. So I would attempt to break the window and remove the gun from her presence.
So I'm strapped with my Gat Essential and Brock Gun 38 in my lap, case I get rocked on.
After verifying that all the officers were in position, I performed a silent three count. I then broke the window on my first attempt using the ASP baton. I then dropped the baton and leaned to tuck my body into the front window to remove the weapon. But as I reached in to grab her gun, I heard a boom, which I believed to be a gun blast go off towards my right ear.
So I'm strapped with my Gat Essential and Brock Gun 38 in my lap, case I get rocked on.
Once inside the vehicle, I can no longer see the weapon. I immediately fell backwards into the pavement, injuring my legs and wrist. I then saw the occupant rise forward in her seat, and while believing that I had been shot and thinking that she was attempting to shoot me again, I began firing into the driver's side door of the vehicle.
I mean, if Tony couldn't hear me, I must be asleep, right?
I began firing into the driver's side door of the vehicle.
If I'm sleeping, I'm dreaming, so it must be deep, right?
I began firing into the driver's side door.
If I'm deep asleep, the police will just wake me up, right?
I began firing into the driver.
Help me find a spare. Even help jack me up, right?
I began firing.
Right?
I began firing.
Right?
I began firing.
Right?
I began firing.
Right? Ever have one of those dreams where nothing comes out when you try to scream?
One. Worst come to worst, my people, they come first. The entrance to gunshot number one. Squeeze first, ask questions last. The entrance to gunshot number one is located on the right upper arm. This is a typical distant gunshot wound entrance. The course of the projectile is through the skin and soft tissue of the right upper arm, perforating and fracturing the right humerus. This is a non-fatal gunshot wound to the right upper arm, fracturing the humerus.
Did he just say humerus? I think he said humerus. That's funny. What's not so funny is the fact that Misha and Tony been working on this new routine. You know, for when we hit the scene. Yeah, that's right. We them girls. You know the ones. Get you on the dance floor thinking you'll have some fun. Thinking you'll get your grind on. Get your freak on. Maybe even get you some. But as soon as we get you on the floor, you realize you gets none. We bust out the routine we came here to do. We ain't being mean. It's just how we do what we do. So you end up standing there bobbing your head. Wonder if you don't get some attention. Create a little tension. So when we see it in your face, give you a taste. Know what I mean? But what you don't realize is that it's all built into the routine.
Maisha, that's the girl that I've ever had. And you know I want to know you better. Girl, I must.
Wow. Wow. Just amazing, folks. And you have to see this. It's at the Los Angeles Theater Center. Downtown, what is it, 514 Spring Street?
Yes, it is.
Yes. And it's just so we get the time, so I don't forget at the end the time.
So we are doing Thursday, Friday, and Saturday performances at 8 p.m. and Sunday matinees at 3 p.m.
All right. And I'm telling you, we're going to continue talking, but you've got to see this. You just heard a taste of it, and it gets deeper and more. It just wraps itself around your heart and your brain and squeezes the hell out of it. Mm. And if you don't have a reaction to it, you're dead. Okay, that's the point. All right, but let me ask you this, because you're John. You actually read the autopsy report, which Rick Kirby. That actually is. It's very heavy that you use that as like the script for this, right? In a certain sense, for that section of the play.
Yeah, you know, the research for this play. There were so many revelations when I started researching the play, and the autopsy report was one of the first things that I read. And when I read through this autopsy report, it pretty much told me it gave me the structure for the play. I immediately knew there would be 12 scenes, and I knew that each scene would represent one of the bullets that hit her. And then I started to read kind of this cold, you know, description of this human being. And that just gave me the point of departure for then creating these different aspects of her.
You know, it's incredible too, because for the audience, it's like that point about the beauty, as we were talking about, you know, Maisha, as we were talking about what you do with her, Rachel, and what you bring out and what the text brings out, but also, you know, really what you bring to it in terms of the spirit, right? And it's sort of, you have that, and then you have that cold, hard 12 bullets. And John, your voice is incredibly just at that place of where, you know these people who get up there, and they get up there in the news, they get up there, whatever, and they just say the most horrific things in just a very steady, but you have there's a timbre to your voice, there's a certain, it's like, it's very, very, it really works, guys. It really works well. It's like, and it is, it's that constant slamming between the beauty of life and the just horror of this kind of murdered death, you know? So let me ask you a question, Rachel. You said when people asked you, apparently at one performance some time ago, some people asked you, and it was around Trayvon Martin, I guess, and they asked you if you thought of Trayvon Martin as you were performing. Mm-hmm. And you said yes, but you also said something that I thought was actually very, very profound, because what you said is that you answered it by saying that yes, because this is a wound that never closes. Let's talk about that. You don't remember saying it.
For me, I think about all of them. I think about every single person, and even the people that are still here with us. This is my way of giving. This is my way of standing up. This is my way of protesting to keep all of those spirits alive, to keep us alive, to talk, to be a voice. And this is my way of expressing it and being able to do this with the talent that I've been blessed with.
You know, and this is both for John and Rick Kirby. You know, the point about hip-hop and the whole hip-hop generation, to a certain extent, which is actually an actual full-blown generation at this point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that that generation is so much the target of what happens right now, and so much a generation that this system is saying it has no future for. You know, let's talk about that in terms of how to infuse, John, your what you've done with this play, and then I'll come back to you, Rick Kirby.
I think there is a heavy misunderstanding with what hip-hop is, and that's one of the things that we take pride in exhibiting and showing, that there are youth, and this generation is very talented and has so much to offer and to deliver into the world. And really all it is just tapping into that and extracting it from them, extracting these talents and these gifts, these ideas and creativity that the younger generation has, and allowing them to, you know, show that they're more than just what gets publicized as far as what hip hop is.
You know, there's something too, though, that actually happens when you look at this. I was thinking about Freddie Gray, 25 years old. Now imagine this. he was okay to do what they did to him, chase him, to stop him, to arrest him.
Yeah.
Because he was a black man in a high crime area. And you think about it, that's the generation we're talking about, a 25-year-old kid. And Maisha, mm-hmm. Taisha, you know? I'll say those both those names because I want to be true to what Absolutely. You're saying about that. But, you know, the same thing, 19 years old, you really see what you've portrayed with what you've written and what you guys have brought to life on the stage is this 19-year-old kid who's bursting with life mm-hmm. and who ends up with a rail between her arms and her feet and carrying her off like a dead slave. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just insane. So let's talk.
You know, part of the dilemma with hip hop culture is that some of the things that are glorified as a means of empowerment have become the excuse for so many things happening to young people from this generation. And so, you know, when NWA puts out a song that says, you know, F the police, and that becomes a means of saying, you know, when I drive around LA and when I'm pulled over for no reason and when these things happen, the only thing I can do is to speak out, yell at the top of my voice. But that yelling then becomes the definition of the person who then in turn becomes a target because of the yelling that occurred, because someone caused them to yell. And it's this ongoing cycle that allows for these types of things to happen. I was recently speaking to a teacher, actually to my sister, who's a teacher in LA, and she was talking about a young man who was recently suspended for something that happened, and he became upset and said something about being suspended in his anger, which in turn caused more suspension, caused more things to happen. And so not having a voice, not having a way of yelling out when you need to, because if you yell too loud, you will be labeled as blank, and then you will be treated as that. And so this idea of taking hip-hop theater and taking hip-hop culture and putting it on stage so that we can tell this entire story, so that we can have an audience sit through and experience this narrative and experience this journey, and then look at how this is, once again, this is not just about Taisha or this character, but it's about those thousands and thousands of voices who are sitting in the car saying, listen, you know, you're supposed to help me out when I call 911, or at least give me enough of an opportunity to wake up from this, you know, whatever this space I'm in.
Right, that's exactly the point, is that even give me the opportunity.
Give me the opportunity.
There's a generation, but that's the thing, is that when you look at this, the standard operating procedure for this system right now is if you're young and you're black, you literally have a target on you and it's open season. I mean, think about one every 28 hours.
Yeah.
You know, this is just, you know, if it was happening, you know, if people just took a slight look back, I talked about the Armenian genocide, the genocide that happened in Germany against the Jewish people, yeah. All of these things, you think about that. And can't we see parallels here? And I'll end with this because we have a whole nother crew waiting to come in,
yeah.
But I'll end with this because there's a point that you made about, and I thought it was beautiful, after the thing, and it was very difficult for people to talk, but after the thing, it was so necessary. You came out there with Kirby and you said, look, we need to have a conversation. What do you want that conversation to be?
Wow. For me, that conversation really is about us finding each other's humanity. And I know that sometimes is this really abstract form, this thing that we talk about. But, you know, we've toured this play around to different places. We've gone over to Europe. We've toured it in places like Poland where, you know, it's not so much about race there, but it's about the powerful and the powerless. And the ability to experience and see someone else's humanity, that's why this play is about us exploring this young woman, to see that there is a human being in that mix. And once we put a number or a label onto that human being, then it becomes easy for us to go, oh yeah, those who are like that are expendable. It becomes more difficult to do that, I believe, when we see each other as human beings. And that's the conversation.
Absolutely. All right. I want to thank you. We're Kirby Hines, Rachel Walker, and John Foss Merchant. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They're here. We're talking about the play Dreamscape. All right, folks. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Bob Avakian and an excerpt from his speech, BA Speaks Revolution Nothing Less. Bob Avakian Live. All right. Stay tuned.
We gon' try in these streets, no longer living on our knees. We better die and on our feet, ready to fight. Black child, 15, 16, empty the
clip, reload and pull the trigger back down. 17, 18, 19, frightening when you hit it right at that sound. 26, 27, every 28 hours, put another body under that ground.
Welcome back. That was a little bit more of just Siri X and Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder. All right, this segment of the show, we're going to be running a segment from Bob Avakian's speech, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live. And this has everything to do with what's going on today. It's all about the epidemic of police murder of black and brown people and just how much longer are we going to allow this hellish situation to go on. Here it is, Bob Avakian.
Well, what we're doing here today is taking place, of course, in the context of the recent elections, about which we're all supposed to be very excited. I don't know how many of you watched the victory celebration at Obama headquarters the night of the election. I couldn't help feeling as I was watching the people there waving their little American flags and bobbing their heads up and down to the music that they reminded me of nothing so much as a bunch of bobbleheads on the dashboard of a car heading for a terrible wreck. And I thought to myself, who else could have gotten all these people there waving those flags? Who else could have got them to applaud for a speech by Obama full of flag waving, patriotism, outright jingoism, America is the greatest country in the world, full of militarism, celebrating the army of empire which marauds around the world, bombing and destroying and taking lives, praising the Navy SEALs for carrying out their heroic assassinations, and ending with this crescendo to the tired old cliche that if you work hard, you can make it in America. The old lie that you can make it if you try. 4 more years was the chant. 4 more years of what? Of crimes? War crimes? Crimes against humanity? 4 more years of silence and complicity and even active apology and support for these crimes on the part of people who call themselves liberals and progressives? Well, I will have more to say about Obama and elections, particularly elections under this system, as we go along. But let's step back from this now and begin with the larger picture and the larger question of what kind of world we live in and why, and what kind of world is possible. If I were a preacher looking out at what goes on with the nightmare of oppression and brutality that so many in this world are forced to endure day after day, generation after generation, I would cry out, how long, O Lord? Now, in case there's any confusion, I am not a preacher, and I'll have more to say about the Lord as we go along. But let's look at what this system does to people. Let's start with just one great crime of this system. Police murder after murder after murder of black people and Latinos, especially youth. Check it out. If you go on the internet and you search for police kill unarmed youth, you will scroll down and down and down and down for pages and pages and pages with the same pattern, the same ugly pattern repeating itself. And you will see that not only are these youth unarmed, but once again, overwhelmingly, they are black and Latino. And if you search a little deeper and a little further, you will see that almost never are the police punished or even prosecuted for these grotesque and wanton murders. And you will run into two of the most wounding words in the English language at this point: justifiable homicide which the family and loved ones of those so wantonly killed are repeatedly slapped in the face with as the verdict on these murders. Let's just take a couple of the latest outrages. Manuel Diaz, murdered by the police in Anaheim, shot in the back, and then shot in the back of the head. While the next day, in the same city of Anaheim, another Latino youth, Joel Acevedo, was also shot down by the police. And here's an irony that came out in relation to the murder of Manuel Diaz. His mother said at one point Manuel was thinking about joining the army. Think about this. You can be a black or Latino youth out on the streets with no prospects and no future. Only the possibility of getting yourself into trouble, running up against other youth just like you and maybe getting into it with them or running up against the police. Or you can join the army of the same system that's put you on the street in that situation to reinforce with brute force the same system that has put you in that situation and to go out into the world and be part of the mindless killing machine doing the same thing to people just like you all around the world. Or what about Oscar Grant, killed a couple of years ago in Northern California by the BART, the Rapid Transit Police? This was also caught on the cell phones of many people. They knocked him to the ground, straddled him while he was face down, and shot him to death. Captured on the cell phones, but it made no difference. Through the lengthy process they always go through, in this case because the people rose up, they had to prosecute. But once again, we run into the situation where strangely, in these kind of situations, the prosecutors who vigorously prosecute with full animus when they're going after someone like Oscar Grant forget how to prosecute when it's the cops on trial. And the whole thing is set up so the cop gets off on a light charge, a minor sentence, and is back out. Think of the outrage of this and the insult on top of the outrage to the family and loved ones and to everyone who cares about justice. Or what about Ramarley Graham in New York City? Killed in his own house by the police. He's walking home in his neighborhood. He's a black youth, so the police assume he must be up to no good. He must be selling drugs. He looks furtive. He's making strange motions. What he's doing is taking out his keys and opening the door to his house. He walks into his own house. He's killed in his own house by the police in front of family and loved ones. And in response to this, his mother comes forward and says, "This has got to stop." And his father, almost as if in a trance, keeps repeating over and over again, "Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son?" And they weren't done yet. The New York cops then came to the courtroom and applauded their fellow pig who murdered Ramarley in cold blood, viciously taunting the family and loved ones of Ramarley and demonstrating yet one more time the ugly truth that in the way this country has been built, and for the powers that be in this country, the humanity of black people has never counted for anything. They have never been valued as human beings, but only as things to be exploited, oppressed, and repressed. How many more times does this have to happen? How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? And if this is not enough, this system viciously exploits people twice, abusing and brutalizing them, and then taking the tortured beauty of their cries of agony and outrage and capitalizing on it, declaring it to be a great expression of the marvelous American culture and its diversity. Think about the blues, for example. There's a lot of stuff in blues that's about personal problems and some nonsense, including men wanting to dominate women. But to a large degree, the blues is about the experience and the suffering of black people in America. Notice it's called the blues, not la 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 la, we're living the American dream. Or how about jazz? I'm thinking of when I moved to Chicago in the 1970s. I didn't have a car and I had to take a cab. And I got in a cab that was driven by this hip young white guy. I don't mean these kind of phonies, they got around, real hip young white guy. As we started talking, it turned out that he was a jazz musician or a musician in general and was just driving a cab to try to be able to keep going. He reminded me of a scene I saw in a Richard Pryor concert where he got up and before he came on the stage, Patti LaBelle and her band had performed. And Richard Pryor said, "Did you see that white guy playing the saxophone up there? He was just like this, with every note. He didn't miss a note. Just like, go ahead, brothers, I'm with you. I ain't missing it. Go ahead, I'm with you." And that's what this cab driver reminded me of. And after we talked a while, he said to me, "Are you into jazz?" And I said, "Well, not really that much. I've listened to some jazz, I like it, but I'm more sort of into rhythm and blues." He said, "You really got to get into jazz. If you listen seriously to jazz, if you listen to Coltrane, what you hear is all the long years of oppression and suffering of black people coming right out the end of his instrument." So I thought, well, I guess I'm going to have to get into jazz some more. But there was a deep truth there. Yes, there's love, as Coltrane put it, a love supreme. But there was also defiance and anger. Now, how many times does this have to keep going on? Now, once again, I'm not a preacher. And if people crying out, "How long, O Lord," could put things right, there should be no more need for people to keep on crying out in this way, and no more need for them to keep on praying. The Lord should have put things right a long time ago. And if the Lord really existed, we would have to ask, what is the matter with the boy that he let things go so wrong for so long in the first place? Now, the truth is, there is no Lord. And we do not need, nor should we want or accept, any lords and masters, imaginary ones or real ones, lording it over us. Some say this is all God's will. No, it is not. And it does great injury to those suffering so terribly and so unnecessarily in this world to tell them that this is God's will or a test that this supposed God has set before them to endure horrible oppression in this world with the promise of a better life in some other world, some afterlife which is not real and will never come. But ask yourself this, if there were a God or gods, why would it be the will of that God or gods that for so long, so many people have suffered so terribly with oppression, degradation, and brutality, while a much smaller number continue to accumulate wealth and exercise power and live lives of parasitic indulgence on the basis of exploiting and oppressing those masses of people all over the world? Why would that be the will of this God? And then let's go on and ask the next question that suggests itself. Whose interest does it serve for people to believe that all this is God's will. Now, I know there are people who feel inspired and sustained by their religious beliefs in the fight against injustice, including the unjust wars repeatedly waged by the American government. Some have spent their lives dedicated to acting on what they identify as prophetic traditions within religion, which they see as calling for standing with and standing up for the poor and oppressed and fighting against injustice. We respect and work to build unity with people holding and acting on those sentiments. In accordance with the communist principles and objectives on which our party is based, we recognize the great importance of reaching out and building unity broadly with people of many diverse viewpoints in the fight against the crimes of this system and the great suffering this causes. And these same principles and objectives also lead us to recognize the importance of boldly and forthrightly putting forward our communist viewpoint and of engaging in serious and principled discussion, and yes, struggle, with people coming from different worldviews in the spirit of seeking the truth and striving to bring forward and to act in the fullest way in accordance with the fundamental interests of the masses of people. It is in this spirit that I am putting forward the views of our party, straight up and full out. Communists are atheists. We do not believe in any gods or any kind of supernatural forces or beings. There is no evidence for the existence of a god or gods, or of any supernatural forces or beings, no evidence which is based in the real world and can be tested in this real world, which is the only existence there is. There is, however, plenty of evidence for the fact that human beings have invented gods and supernatural forces. Now let me say this. I am sick to death of the daily and continual horrors that life under this system means for the great majority of humanity. And I am sick to death of having to say how long, even if not, O Lord. And while I am a firm scientific atheist and do not believe in any gods, I can say, and I do say, God damn these motherfuckers.
That was Bob Avakian, and that was an excerpt from his speech, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, Bob Avakian Live. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com.